let's just be honest, we recognize that the United States has interests. Those interests are not identical to the interests of Ukraine, and we have a right to pursue our interests.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Security Dilemma, a podcast by the John Quincy Adams Society. I'm Patrick Carver Fox, joined by John Allen Gaze. We have a conversation with Dr. Stephen Wertheim, a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. For a second appearance on our show, this time we got to chat in person about Ukraine, NATO, partisanship, and the 2024 elections. Dr. Wertheim is the author of Tomorrow the World, The Birth of U.S. Global Supremacy. He's a leading voice on progressive foreign policy and one of the few people on the left seriously criticizing America's policy toward Europe and Ukraine, so we dive deeper on that. You can catch Dr. Wertheim's work in the New York Times, Washington Post, CNN, and now for a second time, Security Dilemma. Anyway, let's jump into our conversation with Dr. Stephen Wertheim. Dr. Wertheim, congratulations on being the first return appearance on Security Dilemma.
It's an honor and it's a pleasure to be in person with you this time. A throwback to the good old days of podcasting in person.
Well, as we record today on May 7th, what's the most frustrating issue for you in U.S. foreign policy?
I'm afraid it's a proliferation of frustrations. If you look out at the world, at the main things that the United States is trying to do right now, one sees the United States immersed in two wars that are not going to good places, and I'm afraid predictably so, the war in Ukraine and the war in Gaza. You see the United States struggling to manage relations with China, the number two power in the world, which is supposed to be the top priority of U.S. foreign policy. And I think Americans feel that the world is on fire and out of control. And on some level, this is bad and not supposed to happen. And I think on that level, they're right. It's not supposed to happen. The United States set out after the Cold War to suppress security competition through American global dominance. That was the theory, suppress security competition. And what we're seeing now is just the opposite. There is very clear balancing behavior against the United States from major powers, especially China and Russia, but not just them. For every action that the United States takes to assert its power further, there is now an opposite reaction, sometimes an equal reaction, sometimes a greater than equal reaction. And so this is really changing fundamentally how the United States needs to think about its approach to the world. And now you kind of see the situation where either Washington really ups the ante or it starts to pare back. And what we're mostly seeing after the withdrawal from Afghanistan is an approach that ups the ante. We're talking about maybe making a security guarantee to defend Mohammed bin Salman's Saudi Arabia. We're talking about maybe bringing Ukraine into NATO or making some other kind of security guarantee to that country. And we're also talking about potentially raising defense spending well beyond current levels, which are already very high, because I think as honest observers, even if they're primacists, recognize for the United States to keep trying to achieve the objectives it set out for itself requires much greater levels of exertion. So I think this is building pressure in a direction that could be very bad for the United States and certainly isn't what the grand strategy of global primacy was supposed to achieve. But it also, by the same token, creates pressures to say, wait a minute, is this really where we want to go? And make prudent cutbacks to our approach.
Yeah, and you wrote recently on Twitter that that overstretch is going to continue until a major power forces Washington to decide whether to make good on a defense obligation or until Washington chooses to selectively scale back. And it seems like one of those outcomes for the United States is much better than the other. It would be better to choose to right-size our security commitments than to have a major security crisis where we look at some security commitment that's being called due and we have to either fight a major power war for it or back down. You know, so it's a choice between destruction and humiliation. So how do we get to a point, or can we get to a point, where we choose to right-size our commitments rather than having the choice thrust upon us?
Well, I completely agree. I think it takes, in a word, retrenchment. And I think we are seeing pressures in our politics that point in exactly that direction. President Biden, in his first year, did practice some degree of retrenchment and seemed to consider practicing it more widely. But he withdrew from Afghanistan and paid a political price for doing so. It was not obvious when he took office that he would make that choice. But he made it decisively, and I think he deserves a lot of credit for doing that. And it was in line with where the Democratic Party was in the 2020 debate, which was end forever wars, cut defense spending, perhaps keep it at current levels, but don't increase, and focus on climate change and pandemics and the things that directly affect Americans where they live and work. Now, since his first year, I think the Biden administration, partly due to the pressures of the war in Ukraine, has effectively abandoned its initial impulses toward some measure of retrenchment or at least non-expansion of American security commitments and positions. However, we have seen the GOP, I think, become more consolidated in its desire to prioritize the threats and challenges posed by the People's Republic of China and also limit the U.S. commitment to European security. I think the Middle East is a little bit more of a question on the right side of the aisle. We continue to see, in a way we haven't in previous decades in the post-Cold War era, issues of the U.S. pulling back be right at the center of the political agenda. And there's no one party or even flank of a party that has a monopoly on those ideas. My ideas do not perfectly align with any party. I think that's just the reality. But you can see the logic of this position, this retrenchment position, have ever more purchase in Washington and in expert circles, but also in our politics. So that's why I'm working on this and not just writing academic tomes.
Yeah. What might some practical steps toward retrenchment look like? And what would the end goal be? Because there is this talk of prioritization, and that implies a sense of in certain regions, there's more at stake for the United States, or there's more threat to the stake that we have, and that therefore those should be priorities relative to something else. So how does that shake out for you?
So first of all, I think you could talk about priorities on the home front as being the overriding goal. The United States needs to repair its civic life, better attend to the needs of Americans, and in general, having faraway adversaries that provoke us, that we provoke, tends to create divisions and fear in our domestic life. So we should keep that in mind. What is a foreign policy that serves our domestic well-being as, I think, the top priority? But that doesn't mean, of course, that, you know, we can snap a finger and make foreign threats go away. So I think I would put the goal a little bit differently depending on the region. With respect to the Middle East, I think the United States has very limited vital interests, and they are not clearly threatened, even if the United States virtually pulls out of the region. So we could get down to a very small peacetime presence in the region. We should be disentangling ourselves from our unsavory security partnerships and our enmities with bad actors in the region like Iran that don't necessarily need to be threatening the United States or putting us on the brink of a conflict until one day we actually get a direct conflict. It would be a disaster for the United States, as I think most Americans recognize, to be engaged in a large-scale war in the Middle East. But the only way to truly avoid that outcome is to disentangle ourselves from our quote-unquote peacetime relationships in the region. So it's going to be hard to get there, particularly from this moment, but I think the pressures are going to continue to mount as they've mounted for a long time for the United States to do that. With respect to Europe, I think the goal should be to get the Europeans to take the leading role in the defense of Europe. It is their continent. They have the resources to do it. Their latent military power is much greater than Russia's latent military power. Their actual military power needs improvement. So I think there should be a gradual transition to European leadership of European security. There's some alignment with ideas that are floating around on the right that go by the name of a dormant NATO. I agree with some of those ideas, disagree with some of them, but it's good that the concept is out there. And I actually think there's an outside chance that a number of Democrats would also support this kind of idea if they could look at it outside this immediate pressure to decide, do we support Ukraine or do we not support Ukraine? Or fears that there would be a sudden withdrawal from NATO. And then with respect to the Indo-Pacific, I think the United States needs to work toward achieving a relationship of competitive coexistence with China. That means being more competitive in certain respects and retaining a large U.S. peacetime security presence in the region. But it also means demanding more of allies and partners who are, again, more threatened by the potential for Chinese aggression than the United States is. It means focusing on the goal of denying regional hegemony to China rather than trying to deter every kind of negative action that China could take. I think it's actually pretty feasible to deny hegemony to China in the region. And if we could focus on that goal as being the essential goal rather than countering every action in the South China Sea or the First Island Chain, we could have a steadier approach to the region. But we should be also working with China to cooperate where necessary and to try to work out the terms of coexistence. It'd take a lot of hard work. It's going to take a number of years to get there. But I do think that should be the kind of overarching goal. And coexistence has not really been at the center of U.S. approaches right now toward China. I think we're more in a place where the old engagement consensus has been rejected, but a kind of containment-like approach has been the kind of de facto, sometimes not intended, U.S. approach toward China. So I think there needs to be a more conscious process in Washington that asks, what is the end state that we're trying to achieve? So, okay, it's not so easy for me to fit on a bumper sticker. I don't have to do that. That's not exactly my job. I'm supposed to be an expert. So, you know, I've laid it out for you. But I think if we made those kinds of changes over the next decade, U.S. foreign policy would be in a much better place. And we could actually set the priorities that reflectively a lot of our leadership actually wants to set.
Speaking of prioritization and specifically the places where Democrats might need to catch up to Republicans a little bit, there was a phrase used by Dr. John Holzman when he came on our show a little while ago, if you love everything, you love nothing. If you kind of say that everything is a priority, which I think there's some inherent instinct to do within the sort of big tent Democratic Party, how do you change that? How do Democrats kind of come to terms with the limits of American power and really kind of say out loud the hard things like we can't focus on the Middle East this much? What do you think the steps are to taking the people who are currently part of that sort of coalition and making them prioritize?
Certainly won't be easy. And we have, again, the record, the recent record of the Biden administration that I think was trying to prioritize and then found itself in crisis mode responding to events. Look, I think the main lesson that needs to be learned is that it's hubristic to think that the United States can leave itself entangled in security arrangements across the globe and then set priorities and say, yeah, we're going to be the key linchpin of security in the Middle East and Europe, but we're going to focus on Asia today because we think that's really most important. So you all in the Middle East, you sit still. You guys in Europe, you sit still. That's just not the way the world works. And I think we have ample evidence from the last few years to come to that conclusion. So that's why prioritization is a totally empty concept without a notion of disentanglement, without being willing to disentangle the United States, to retrench, to cut back from some places, the United States will simply not be able to set the kind of priorities that it wants to set. I think there's been also a fantasy occasioned by the kind of triumphalism of the early war in Ukraine that the U.S. was going to solve the problem of overcommitment and overstretch by cutting Russia down to size and kind of shrinking the adversaries and maybe getting these gestures of cooperation across theaters from U.S. allies in Europe and U.S. allies in Asia. So there's this kind of new theory that tries to grapple with the failure of primacy to date, but kind of return to the original idea that the U.S. can be globally ensconced in security arrangements, even with these new adversaries, because the adversaries themselves are actually weak or will become weaker. And we also see this wishful thinking applied to China with China's economic doldrums of late. Those are real economic problems, but for the United States to actually be able to keep doing what it's doing at a reasonable cost, you know, not perpetually on the brink of World War III, you know, would require the Chinese economy to really collapse. This is not a good premise for strategy. And of course, we've seen Russia reconstitute, unfortunately, its defense industrial base over the 2+ years of the war in Ukraine. So that fantasy, I think, needs to be discredited, that somehow the growing alignment of U.S. adversaries, while unfortunate, doesn't really amount to some kind of serious problem for the United States, and it can be easily managed.
I want to talk a little bit about a recent change in how the Democrats have specifically approached the sort of the limits of Ukraine. Recently, Representative Adam Smith, a well-established center-left supporter of Ukraine and a ranking member of the House Armed Services Committee, had an interesting rebuke of some of the maximalism in Ukraine. He said, "I've heard this phrase over and over, nothing about Ukraine without Ukraine. Forgive me. That is a ridiculous thing for any U.S. diplomat or person in U.S. policy to say. We've got partners all over the world, and yes, we listen to them, but when we're fitting the bill, when we're spending so much money over there, we have a say." Now, we can't get too excited because Smith voted for that, you know, $95 billion package, but how can we interpret such frustration from folks like Representative Smith? Is there messaging that should be employed, that isn't being employed to sway people with his perspective?
Well, again, I had the luxury of not having to think too hard about messaging as opposed to content. So, look, I think we've actually seen under the surface a number of Democrats express concerns about the U.S. approach in the war in Ukraine. There was, of course, that debacle over a letter that was signed and then unsigned that was calling for negotiations of some sort, and now Representative Smith's comments. But frankly, I think the truth is, the United States always recognizes that when it gives security assistance to a partner or an ally, it has a right to weigh in on how that assistance is used. In fact, there are laws requiring that the United States make sure that U.S. military aid isn't going to abuse human rights, et cetera. Notwithstanding that, the Biden administration, which does say things like, nothing about Ukraine without Ukraine, and, you know, Ukraine has a right to decide whether and when to engage in negotiations over the war, also puts limitations on the support that the United States provides. So let's just be honest. We recognize that the United States has interests. Those interests are not identical to the interests of Ukraine, at least, you know, as the government in Kyiv conceives of those interests, and we have a right to pursue our interests. So, you know, unfortunately, there's this debate that's kind of been clouded by the notion that the war is really a war for Ukraine's self-determination and the justice concern, therefore, should dominate concern about consequences, strategy, etc. Ukraine must win. Winning means kicking all Russians out of Ukraine's internationally recognized 1991 borders. Don't worry about the risk of nuclear war. It's either not going to happen or we have to ignore it because we can't give in to nuclear blackmail. This kind of thinking is, I think, rooted in a conception of, you know, moral necessity and justice. And that's always present in our foreign policy debates. And I don't think there's, you know, no room at all for concerns of justice. I do think Ukraine is on the right side of this conflict, for sure. It's a clear-cut war of aggression by Russia. Even if, you know, Russia's claims about, you know, creeping NATO enlargement are wholly accepted, that doesn't amount to a claim that Ukraine was attacking or about to attack Russia, and that Russia would therefore have a legal right to invade Ukraine. So I think people around the world understand what Russia has done is a fundamental violation of international law and the UN Charter, and it's a big problem. At the same time, you always need strategy in foreign policy, and it is a fundamental mistake to lapse into this view that perfect justice must be achieved, damn the consequences. You always have to think about, calculate what the consequences are. Some have made this mistake in prior decades with respect to humanitarian intervention, where there was a lot of talk about how the genocide is occurring, the international community should immediately step in, and never mind what the aftermath of war would look like. And then neoconservatives after September 11th also applied this sort of mentality to invading Iraq. Well, what could be worse than Saddam Hussein's rule? Let's overthrow him. What will emerge afterwards? I don't know. We'll figure it out. Well, it turns out it can get worse. It can always get worse. And when you have nuclear weapons in the balance, you're damn right it can get worse. So we have to think very carefully about, you know, where we're going in Ukraine. And I think, you know, in a way, the Biden administration's strategy with respect to Ukraine is sensible, but it's very capacious. So it is sensible to try to strengthen Ukraine's hand on the battlefield to enable Ukraine to have a strong position in eventual negotiations that would terminate the war. That is, I think, the primary objective of the Biden administration and has been from the start. Another objective has been to avoid a direct war between the United States and NATO forces on the one hand and Russian forces on the other in or over Ukraine. Also, extremely important goal. The problem is, how does one determine when it's appropriate to start talking, maybe to keep fighting, but to start talking between the Ukrainians and the Russians, with the U.S. playing an important role necessarily? And we do not have an answer to that question. And it seems like over the course of more than 2 years now, when Ukraine is doing poorly in the war, then, of course, that's a reason to step up support for Ukraine to get them able to defend themselves. But as soon as we do that, and we saw this with the passage of the recent aid, well, then we start talking about going on the counteroffensive in 2025, maybe later. Well, where does it end? At what point does Washington, Kyiv, European allies say, this is actually potentially the best position that Ukraine is going to be in for the future, and therefore it makes sense for us to do everything we can on acceptable terms to open up negotiations to settle the war. So we're, you know, looking like we're pretty close to an endless war at this point. Not endless necessarily in terms of longevity. It's only been 2+ years. But endless, I think, in the more profound sense of not having an objective that can be specified or be fulfilled. We have a partner in Ukraine that's saying it's fighting to kick all Russians out of Ukraine and reestablish its 1991 borders, perfectly within Ukraine's rights under international law to do that, but not obtainable. And most policymakers in Washington, I think, understand that that is not an obtainable objective. Moreover, not even necessarily a desirable objective for the United States or for NATO allies in Europe, because, for example, if Ukraine were able to credibly threaten to retake Crimea, that is something that could plausibly trigger the use of nuclear weapons from Russia, unfortunately. So that is a kind of the de facto goal of the war effort. And then you have Ukraine's partners, its main partners, saying, well, we don't actually want or need you to get to your 1991 borders, but we're not going to say what our limits are. And we just want to keep supporting you until you're ready to talk. So you see how we kind of revert then to Ukraine's definition of what it's fighting for. And there is no generally agreed upon set of objectives short of total victory in Western capitals. So we have to find a way to force this conversation about, well, what really are we in it for? short of getting into a very hairy situation where we could have a resort to nuclear war, or more likely, short of the war going on many, many years, Western support flagging, and Ukraine actually suffering a worse position on the battlefield, not to mention the destruction of life in Ukraine itself, for no gain. We could be sitting here 5 years from now with Ukraine in a worse position, Western will having dissipated, and we'll be saying, did it make sense to castigate all those people who were saying, why don't we explore negotiations 5 years ago? We all have to keep in mind that these are difficult choices. I don't want to, you know, say otherwise, but we can't hide behind slogans like don't fear nuclear war or nothing about Ukraine without Ukraine.
So the other side is kind of wrong about the approach to Ukraine. What would a good approach to Ukraine to kind of resolving this conflict look like? Because the flip side of this is it seems like Russia is playing a pretty strong hand right now. They've been making gains on the battlefield. It appears that there's some gaps in ammunition availability between what the Russians have and what the Ukrainians have. You could make a case that there's a long-term balance of forces in their favor. Domestically, the war seems to be working for Putin. It's enabled some consolidation in their economy. They seem to be building a bit of a sanctions economy that's less dependent on ties to Europe. So why would they settle with us right now? Because they're in a strong position, and it seems like they can make it stronger on the battlefield.
I unfortunately do agree with your premise that it looks like time is more on Russia's side at the moment than it is on Ukraine's side. Wars have to come to an end somehow. And just because time is on Russia's side, at least arguably so, doesn't mean Russia doesn't have incentives to end the war if it can do so in a way that's acceptable to its leadership. So the war is creating problems for Russia and its leadership, as well as providing some solutions. It is making Russia more dependent on China, and that is not a place where many Russians want to actually be. The longer the war goes on, the higher the cost that Russia pays, the more leverage China, I think, is likely to have over Russia. Russia also has to calculate that, you know, Western escalation may be a factor in the future. That would not be desirable for Russia, might not be desirable for the West either, but it could happen. And then I think the question is, what are the terms that would be sufficient for Russia to make peace? And are they obtainable from the West? So even if Russia's in a stronger position, if it can get terms that are acceptable and that put a stop to the enormous costs in terms of manpower and the economic costs too, then that would be a reason why Russia might make a deal. But the fact is, I think it will take a while from the beginning of peace talks to their conclusion. It usually does. The Korean War is an example of that. We're talking a many-year process. The fighting and the talking happen simultaneously. And I'm afraid we just haven't had these discussions to test the proposition since the opening months of Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. So I think, unfortunately, diplomacy has been stigmatized as tantamount to appeasement, and that's made it even more politically difficult to do what the Biden administration says it wants to do, which is get to a negotiated end to the war with Ukraine having decent terms or a stronger hand than it might otherwise be able to attain. So in short, we have to try, and talking doesn't mean you accept whatever the Russians have to say. And I also think, of course, the Russians cannot be trusted to keep their word. They're not going to follow international law because they really believe in the spirit of international law, and they're great legalists and moralists. So Ukraine, I think, will need to believe in its own deterrent capability in a post-war environment. So I support something like the what's been called the Israel model for Ukraine, but basically helping to build up the Ukrainian armed forces to provide an effective deterrent against further Russian aggression.
You were talking about a model for future American-Ukrainian relations, and Dr. Sumantra Maitra has written a great deal about the concept of a dormant NATO. This idea has gained traction in Trump kind of circles. As someone on the left who is also critical of how America engages with Europe, what do you think a better future for a progressive administration would look like in terms of engaging with Ukraine, but also NATO and Europe in general?
I think Biden missed an opportunity, both in his first year in office and after February of 2022, to start effectuating burden shifting toward European leadership of European defense. And that would be my shorthand for what I think the goal should be for the United States. He had a kind of a nice ready-made line where he could say, well, look, I'm Transatlantis' best friend, but the future isn't going to be somebody like me. Look at how old I am. And it may well be literally Donald Trump or else the Trump-led Republican Party. So let's work together to work out a transition plan. Now, he didn't do that. But I think you could find another Democratic administration realizing that that's the best way to go. And I also think there's an awakening happening in Europe, especially over the last couple of years, interestingly enough, despite the many years of having Trump being a key figure in American politics, where this notion that Europe, like it or not, is probably going to have to be capable of defending itself and cannot rely on Washington to provide a security umbrella, it's taking hold. So the Europeans may help to force the issue. One thing I fear, though, is that the kind of old playbook for keeping the U.S. in as a security guarantor in Europe will be effectively employed. That is to say, buying arms from the United States, which American politicians tend to like, which does not build the European defense industrial base, which does not then create a political constituency in Europe in favor of higher defense spending. So that's a very important problem that needs to be addressed. The EU has put out some really ambitious guidelines recently for building the defense industrial base. I applaud that, but I'm not all that confident that either party would have leadership that would truly be able to pass up the opportunity to sell American. So I think that's one major problem. But what I would hope that, you know, whether it's Democrats or Republicans, future administrations will do is recognize it is much better to have a responsible transition to European leadership of European defense than continue to play this high wire act of will the U.S. completely abandon Europe this year, or maybe it'll be next year, maybe it'll be the year afterwards. And then that actually really is the one thing the United States could plausibly do to European allies that truly jeopardizes their security. We should focus on avoiding that outcome and hopefully work together. If not, it can be U.S.-led with Europe having to figure out how to do it. But we've got to focus on avoiding that outcome because at the end of the day, Europe should be much more powerful than Russia. It has the resources. It needs to learn to work together, cooperate on defense issues, and replace U.S. responsibilities and capabilities.
Zooming out to the broader U.S. discourse on foreign policy, there's a left and a right side of the coalition pushing for greater restraint in U.S. foreign policy. And at the working level, like in, you know, on K Street or whatever, there's a lot of great working relationships there. There's a lot of great working relationships on the Hill. And yet, in practice, it seems like it's manifesting in partisan ways where one side's really revved up and it's hard for the other side to get on side. So like with the recent protests against the Gaza war, they've been largely a left-wing phenomenon. They've faced growing backlash from the right. With efforts to limit U.S. involvement in Ukraine, it's been driven almost entirely by the right. And then even some of the more traditionally cross-partisan phenomena like this recent fight in Congress about renewing and extending Section 702 surveillance powers was predominantly opposed by Republicans. And so the press portrayed it in those terms rather than recognizing, hey, there's like a big number of traditional civil liberties Democrats who are also backing this up. So are we doomed to be a divided movement where we can only ever punch with one of our arms at a time? Or is this something where there might be new opportunities for people to work together more effectively?
Just to riff on your question before I answer it, it's striking to me that some of the criticisms that come from the left on Gaza policy mirror the criticisms that come from the right on Ukraine policy. Like, why is the U.S. giving virtually unconditional support to another country, Israel, for conducting military operations that may not be in American interests and certainly come with major costs, financial and reputational? Similarly, some Republican critics on Ukraine, where is our strategy? Are American interests being prioritized over interests of partners and allies? And yet, you can point that out all you like. I don't think that's going to change political leadership, you know, airing these sorts of concerns. They're not going to see the light and go, oh, gee, I really should be consistent. But that's okay. I think that leads me to the answer, which is that it's just a reality of our politics that negative polarization is shaping most politicians and many ordinary Americans' views on foreign policy. That is to say, a lot of people derive their views on a range of political issues, including foreign policy, from, oh, my partisan opponent is taking this position, therefore I'm very suspicious of that, and will take a different oppositional position. So we see the parties sort of sort on different foreign policy issues, sometimes in a, you might say, a primacy direction, sometimes in a restraint direction. That's just the reality. People in foreign policy, no matter who you are, aren't going to be strong enough to change the problem of polarization in this country. And I don't think anyone's got a great solution for that. So as long as we're in this position, one thing it does mean is opportunities to work together and sometimes to at least create a consensus on a party level. So I think in general, the degree of polarization we have is lamentable and it's not good for the cause of realism and restraint. That said, it does provide an opportunity when a party becomes oppositional on a particular issue to make others in the party say, hey, you like these people in general, and they've got something to say that's right about this issue. And so I think we saw, you know, the Republican Party, I think many who were initially holding up the Ukraine aid in the fall of last year did not expect it to get as far as it got. But they saw that more and more Republicans, voters and elites and politicians became concerned that the strategy wasn't working at a minimum, whether that meant that aid should be completely opposed under any conditions or whether there should be conditions. I think there was more disagreement on that score, and I lament the fact that both the proponents of aid and the opponents of aid did not really come forward offering conditions to the other side that would allow the people to meet in the middle and renew aid, but with a clarified, improved strategy. That was my optimal outcome for the Ukraine aid. And instead, we saw both sides polarize, which I think is really important. And part of the reason that I think they polarize is that the division occurred on party lines. And so the parties didn't want to be seeming to come to the other side and give that side a partial win. That is a problem with the partisanship in foreign policy.
Speaking of polarization, how should this movement for greater realism and restraint be interpreting the significant mobilization of young people in opposition to the war in Gaza?
I think it's very important that people are mobilized around the war in Gaza. I've been extremely alarmed about where that war was going to go from quite early on. You know, there's an endless debate over what are the protests really about, and you can always find in any protest, including the protests against the Iraq war, you can always find people who take extreme positions that I wouldn't agree with. You're already hearing in my voice that I'm not the protesting type. I'm the speaking to you from a think tank type for better or worse. But I think on balance, you look at what is prompting the protests, what in the world is going on. It's a really disproportionate use of violence by Israel against civilians in Gaza. And it's happening both with direct U.S. material support and political support of Benjamin Netanyahu's government and over the objections of American policymakers who seem to know better, who seem to think that Israel can do better than what it's doing, and yet aren't willing to put their money where their mouth is and say, well, if you do something that isn't the right thing to do, then you just shouldn't get American support to do that. The principle here ought to be clear cut. I think there's some real opportunity here with the election coming up. It's going to be a close election, I'm sure. And if President Biden does not prevail, his foreign policy, I think, will be a significant reason why. Probably enough to swing the outcome of the election, potentially, depends, but it'll be a factor, or it's a real factor that's coming up in public opinion polls. People really are concerned about foreign policy, and Gaza's at the forefront of that. If he loses to Donald Trump because of the Gaza issue, I think we could see a defining generational moment for Democrats where they say, you can never again defy your progressive base and lose an election to somebody like Trump out of this kind of unconditional blind support for Israel. Don't ever make that mistake again. And it could also be a lesson that's expanded more broadly to foreign policy, given that I don't think the Ukraine war is a political winner for Biden at this point either. So I think there is potential here. What concerns me a little bit is that totally understandable that protests are usually aimed at a specific event. And in this case, it's focused on the Israel-Palestine issue. The Israel-Palestine issue is, you know, one of the few foreign policy questions that animate a portion of Americans. It's been a relatively well-saturated part of U.S. debate. What I'm concerned about is that that issue will be viewed in isolation and will not be connected to the broader U.S. role in the Middle East or the broader U.S. role in the world. So I think it's important to draw those connections so that whatever lessons are taken from the mistakes of U.S. policy, they're not too narrowly cast. For example, the Biden administration is now trying to get this deal with Saudi Arabia, which it was trying to do before the war in Gaza, but it's trying to revive that. And I think the basic political appeal of this would be to allow the president to stand up and say, okay, we went through a horrible period in the region, but now I have helped to bring peace, to bring about diplomatic normalization between Israel and Saudi Arabia. And, you know, now things will be a lot better going forward. And he's trying to get some kind of progress toward a two-state solution as part of that deal. I'm very skeptical that any of that will materialize. But nevertheless, this is, people in the White House are very serious that this kind of deal can be put together and would be politically helpful to the president. That suggests a view that, you know, there are some people who don't like what Israel's doing in its war, but would be receptive to the U.S. making a security commitment to defend Saudi Arabia and therefore more deeply enmeshing the United States in the security affairs of the region. So I think, you know, the dots need to be connected that in a region where, first of all, the United States has very few vital interests that are imperiled, for the U.S. to side with some actors in the region to the point where we're willing to go to war on their behalf against other actors in the region, that's really unwise, and that's exactly what's going on with respect to U.S. support for Israel's military operations in Gaza.
Well, I think that's all the time that we have for today, but Dr. Stephen Wertheim, thank you so much for coming on Security Dilemma.
Well, my pleasure.
Security Dilemma is a podcast by the John Quincy Adams Society. To learn more about our programs, visit our website at jqas.org. Remember to rate and review in your podcast app and join us every Tuesday for new episodes of Security Dilemma.